Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I definitely think in a more remote first working environment, people will have to get very smart about how they use humour to connect teams when you can't actually physically be with one another. And I think successful leaders will definitely invest time in doing that.
Welcome to the Humorology Podcast with me, Paul Barros, and my glittering lineup of guests from the worlds of business, sport and comedy, who are going to share their wisdom and their use of humour. Humorology is the study of how humour can dramatically improve your business success and your life. Humorology puts the fun into business fundamentals, increases the value of your laughing stock, and puts a punchline back into your bottom line. Please remember to like, subscribe, and leave a review wherever you get your podcasts. Our guest on this edition of the Humorology Podcast is a hugely experienced publishing director and content expert who has been group advertising director at Hearst and executive director and publisher at the huge media brands of Cosmopolitan and Stylist. Recently, she spurned the traditional media to become managing director of Acast, the world's leading podcast marketplace. She looks after some of the world's most listened to and influential podcasts, whose content catalogue gets more than 225 million listens each month on every platform, from Apple to Google to Spotify. She's committed to continually supporting and amplifying the voices that have not been supported in the mainstream media. She's also committed to making business more fun. Georgina Holt, welcome to the Humorology Podcast.
Thank you so much, Paul. What a wonderful introduction. I'll give you the money later. Thanks so much.
It was all true and it was all from the heart.
Thank you.
You make a number of huge podcasts around the world, as I said in my introduction, and a number of the top podcasts at Acast have humour in them. I'm thinking of about Snog Married Annoyed or Shag Married Annoyed or whatever.
That's the one.
Off the Menu, Adam Buxton, and my favourite title ever, My Dad Made a Porno. Which is funny in itself. How does humour elevate podcasts?
I mean, I think it's just the most wonderful format for comedy, you know, the audio format where the end user or the audience can go on their own visual journey and connect the dots of the gag via their own internal landscape. I just think it's the most wonderful format to do that. And it's a real place for escapism as well. I think that we often, you know, forget that the audio landscape is a beautiful place to escape to. And I think comedy, particularly in that format, can be done to the most exquisite standards, whether it's high production value, whether it's a conversation between two friends, whether it's, you know, a conversation around food or relationships. There's so much to explore within the podcasting landscape, particularly in the comedy space. And we've seen some brilliant respected comedians transition to podcasting as a platform for their art and self-expression, but also people who aren't broadcasters, people who haven't come up through traditional media, find their voice and their community on podcasts via comedy. And I just love the fact that we enable that to happen. It's a wonderful thing to kind of see take shape and grow.
And does it affect how you actually gauge whether a podcast is going to be right for Acast? Do you think, whatever it is, if it's gardening or cookery or anything, is comedy the difference that makes the difference?
I mean, I think because podcasting is so broad and can speak to any sort of niche interest or passion you know, community and audience, that there really is something for everyone. So comedy can be quite sort of subjective and personal. So whilst we don't kind of judge, like, is this funny or is this not funny, we know the communities that do find it funny, and is this going to resonate with them? Is this going to find their people and their place on our network through the power of podcasting? So I think it's sort of, rather than us judging whether something is going to be funny, we kind of let it grow organically over time. And quite often, you know, the big broadcasters will come to us and want to launch a podcast, and we know they'll bring a certain audience with them. But sometimes the joy is seeing the smaller podcasters just grow organically over time and start to become, you know, the really big giants that we know and love today.
And is there a difference, because direct comedy, because I as you may know, I used to work in comedy, and something that is just witty, something that's just humorous, that something that has a light touch, does that make a difference?
I think it does. I think, you know, what you find in a lot of podcast comedy formats is it's quite observational, it's quite conversational, it's usually set in something that is common to all of us. You know, we see a lot of great podcasts use comedy talking about food and relationships, I've already said. So I think the deftness of touch and the lightness of touch that can be done through the audio experience can, you know, be amplified tenfold that perhaps it wouldn't be done in the visual space. So I think, you know, you don't see as many sort of direct stand-up style podcasts. It tends to be the art of comedy through conversation and observation that we see really kind of, I guess, engage audiences and really find that growth over time that we all want everyone to have. So I think it really depends on who you're trying to reach and why you want to reach them and the community you intend to build around it. And that's where we see the greatest success.
So what makes you laugh?
Oh, that's a great question. I'm very quick to laugh. I really love story-based humour, kind of that humour that's based in sort of incisive, awkward reality, like Fleabag, or humour that kind of makes the everyday funny, or takes the everyday and elevates it to a place where it becomes exceptional wit and comedy, like This Country or The Office. So I kind of like reality and observational based comedy. And I love, you know, comedy that builds a narrative and a story over time. So I'm very attracted to that type of laughter. I'm certainly very quick to laugh in those situations when I see it.
So you mentioned Fleabag, which I think was the exceptional comedy probably of the last 5 years, if not more. And do you think that now we are going to get more people coming through? Because I know that one of your passions is to bring people through who don't normally have a voice. And do you think that this is a way to get more voices, especially humorous voices, out there?
I mean, absolutely. Podcasting is an amazing format. As long as you have a good piece of recording equipment, something to say, and the ability to say it in a way that's going to engage people, the opportunity is there for you to kind of start building an audience and growing a podcast. And I think what Phoebe Waller-Bridge did so beautifully was to take, I mean, it started off as a theatre production. So, you know, it's a one-woman show, which I saw and was lucky enough to see. So she managed to take what was, I think, probably one of the most beautifully observed comedic performances and translate it from the stage to the screen. I'm sure it would have done beautifully well in a podcast as well. And I particularly loved about that is the breaking of the third wall, when she's kind of, you know, winks at you and, you know, you're in on the joke, you're with me on this, we're all in this together. And it's a very, very useful and effective tool in comedy. And I particularly enjoyed that because it was, I think, taking some of the most, you know, saddest and tricky moments in a woman's life and poking fun at it and making it funny and relatable and energizing and sad and empathetic all at the same time. I just think she did an incredible job. And I hope that has just encouraged more and more female writers, and I hope more diverse female writers to be brave enough to start to put their story out there and use that as a place to find comedic escapism, not only just for themselves, but for the audience they're intending to reach.
And do you think that podcast model is going to be the breakthrough that lots of people need? Because I come from the comedy circuit, and you know, it takes a lot to get up on the comedy store stage, but it doesn't take so much to put up a microphone and tell your story. So do you think that more people, because presumably you can record a podcast on your phone?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, Acast has got some amazing technology to enable the kind of bedroom podcaster to really start to create something of a good standard that's going to be, you know, heard well. And what we really want to do, and why I love podcasting so much, is we are a very democratic media. You know, we are here to help storytellers find the audiences they deserve. And, you know, whether that's storytelling through comedy, storytelling through observation, conversation, you know, that is what podcasting has enabled people to do. And I think Apple reached a milestone recently. There's 1 million podcasts on Apple. So, you know, from a format to use for self-expression, I think people are really understanding the power of that and the flexibility of that medium. And we've certainly seen it through the pandemic period, or in the last couple of months, is that the flexibility and agile nature of podcasting has meant that we've seen more creators create more content than ever before. We saw record weeks in terms of the number of episodes being produced, the number of people coming to podcasts, not only from an audience perspective, but also from a creative perspective as well. So I think the format itself has proved more so than ever over the last few months. Not only is it there to kind of engage an audience in a really meaningful and, you know, emotive and trusted space, but also is allowing creators the opportunity to produce content at a very easy, cost-effective, agile way.
And how do you think that's going to affect the diversity of, you know, messages coming in? Because, you know, that's what the media hasn't been terribly good at, or traditional media, because there have been barriers. And I think what you're saying and what you're leading as a leader is a revolution, isn't it? To make sort of your message accessible to more people. What advice would you give to somebody sat at home in, let's just say, Hartlepool, you know, who thinks, I can't get into the media? What would you say to them?
I mean, podcasting is an amazing place to start experimenting and finding your voice, finding your narrative, finding your point of view, your perspective. It's a great testing ground for ideas too, because you don't have to have the investment of, you know, production companies or, you know, big broadcasters behind you. You can test ideas in podcasting really rapidly to know whether that they are going to be effective, they're going to engage people. You can get immediate feedback from audiences as well if you've got a social media presence too. So it's a brilliant place to test ideas. It's a great place to understand whether something is engaging the audience you wanted it to engage, or even an audience you didn't expect it to. And we've seen, you know, podcasts grow organically over time from, you know, 100 listens to 100,000 listens, but also, you know, for huge global talent and broadcasters to come to audio as a place for their own self-expression, which I think is really one of the only places that uniquely happens. Not only does it allow someone who is literally in a bedroom with a mobile phone creating a platform for their artistic expression, but then also to bring, you know, the original first lady, Michelle Obama, to podcasting, Dolly Parton to podcasting, you know, Louis Theroux, these incredibly experienced orators alongside these, these more kind of inception or early start podcast is a really beautiful thing, and I really don't think there's many other mediums that allow that to happen.
It is a great leveler, and it's lovely to hear somebody who's a leader being in that place, who is trying to get everything leveled up. Because having been around the traditional media like you have for so many years, you must have seen that it's a hard place to break into. If I live in Grimsby and I want to write for Cosmopolitan, it's not necessarily an easy thing, or the BBC or ITV or Channel 4.
So many of these big companies were London centric. You don't need to be in London to be a successful podcaster. You don't need to be of a certain age, body type, look. You don't have to be from a certain, background, ethnicity. None of those requirements, or certainly traditional requirements of success in broadcasting and in other media, none of that matter here. You know, in fact, we celebrate the diverse. We celebrate the voices. We want to champion those voices, and we want to bring more diverse voices to podcasting. Once you found podcasts, you can't get away from them. You become it's so sticky. You become addicted to the format, and you're just constantly on this journey of discovery just to find more and more and more.
Tell me a funny story about something that's happened to you.
I was thinking about this earlier, about funny stories, and quite often they seem to involve me falling or clothes or something ridiculous happening to me. I was on a date once and I really liked the guy, not the guy I ended up marrying, this, was a date before him. And we got into the taxi and I thought, this is going really well. I really like this guy. And I slid what I thought was vaguely seductively across the taxi, and the door was open on the other side. So I went straight back out the other side of the taxi, head over feet onto the floor, which was, quickly tried to recover. And we both knew from that point onwards, it probably wasn't going any further. I have been in the reception of a media agency before and had a wraparound skirt on, which I trod on as I stood up to greet the person, and my skirt stayed on the seat and I didn't. So that was also a brilliant moment and a much loved story. It tends to be almost, I guess, physical comedy, like I fall, I do something ridiculous and silly. But yeah, it's usually in those spaces. I'm quick to laugh at myself as well. I think it's really important.
Well, is that the hidden meaning in those stories, that you have to be quick to laugh at yourself?
I think so. I think for me, it's kind of, life will often throw you a curveball. And when that happens, I try and often think about what's the story I will tell someone about what's happened, and how I can find the comedy in that story, or the humor in that story, even those kind of awkward and challenging moments. I think it sort of helps me process feelings as well. And I think if I can find the comedy in something, I usually know that it's going to be okay in the long term. Whether it doesn't feel like it in the moment, I usually know it's going to be okay in the longer term.
But is that the advice you would give to other people as well? Because you are in a big leadership role. You've been in big roles in media. Mm. How important, because that's really the essence of the Humorology podcast, is, why should people use humour more in business? So would you take that lesson away and give it to somebody else?
Absolutely. I think, desperately try and seek out the humour in something. If you can't find it, then, fair enough. Sometimes there isn't humour in everything. I absolutely know that. But if you can find it, if you can cling on to it and you can keep it close to you, you'll be surprised how quickly scenarios and situations become diffused, either internally or externally.
Well, but you would advise others to do it as
well. Yeah, absolutely.
And our listeners here, I would say, as a psychologist, what Georgie has just said is actually the ultimate. Humour is the best medicine, because what it does is it changes the structure of your brain. So if you're laughing at something, it's very hard to sort of be annoyed, to go into a depression. You break the state, as it were. And so what you're actually deploying is actually a real mechanism for change in yourself. So I'd advise anybody.
Yeah. Fascinating. I'd also advise anyone to find someone who makes you laugh as well. I quite often in tough or intense situations in work or in life, I will often try and find someone who makes me laugh quite quickly afterwards, because I just want to have that emotional and physical release of laughter, which I think we all understand how that feels. And I would always know the two or three people I would try and find after a tough negotiation or client conversation, or, you know, I would try and seek out those people who would level the situation, make me laugh either at myself, the situation, or something else entirely. And I found that an amazing tool, I think, to process feelings. I always felt it was easier after the fact, after the laughter, in fact, to process an emotion.
Well, that's really interesting. Do you think consciously or unconsciously, when you are hiring people, you are looking for a sense of humour?
I think I'm looking for someone who can find the lightness of touch in situations. Now, that often comes through humour and through someone who's able to laugh quickly in an interview. I would love someone to be able to laugh with me and laugh along together, whether that's over a shared joke or a connection that we both have. I do like to see that in an interview situation, because it shows to me that even in stressful situations, which interviews can be quite intense, someone is able to find the humour even in that situation. I don't necessarily focus on seeking it out, but I do like to see it.
I think, you see, as a psychologist who's specializing in humorology, I think it's the missing bit of the puzzle. But not everybody consciously gets it. They just go, I like the person. But actually, humor is sometimes the key to that bond, isn't it? That if you can laugh together. I think it was Victor Borg, the old-time Danish comedian, who said, a smile is the shortest distance between two people.
Absolutely. And there is a thrill in making someone laugh, isn't there? There is a thrill in finding that moment that you have said something that has made someone else laugh. It's a thrilling feeling, you know, whether you actively seek it out. And I think it, you know, I love being made to laugh by other people.
Is everyone funny?
Probably to someone somewhere, but not always to me. I would love to think that everyone's funny to someone somewhere. I don't know whether that is always true, but I'd like to think so. There's an audience for most.
Yeah. I think you're hedging your bets there.
I am.
Because as a psychologist, I could see your eye accessing cues, and you were going, Oh no, I remember that person. They definitely weren't funny to anyone.
Maybe to themselves. You know, maybe they're hilarious to themselves, and maybe that's okay.
Well, that's schizophrenia generally. I quite like your optimism. I do really like your optimism that everyone is funny to someone somewhere. I think it's a nice thing, because also what that shows, because a lot of leaders I talk to in business and work with in business, I always tell them the same thing, that when you walk into a room, and I think this is what you have in spades, if you like, is that you like people automatically and it comes across. Do you do that consciously, or is it just something that is you?
I think it's something that I've got much better at over time, or certainly have. You know, I've kind of really come to learn, really come to land on and understand that, you know, while sometimes we're all experiencing the same thing, no one's experience is the same. So I have tried to reserve and remove judgment as much as I can from first meetings with people, because you never quite know what they've experienced, the hours, the days, the weeks before they've come into that room. So I try and always go with an open heart and an open mind. I can quickly get that closed down over, you know, after a brief conversation with someone, you know, that does happen from time to time, but I think I consciously do it. I certainly have got better at it. I think, you know, it's an understanding of human beings over time that you build, that, you know, people's experiences are different and they're not always going to bring their best selves to the room on that day, and understanding that is important.
So what would the world be like without humour?
I can't actually imagine it. I genuinely couldn't. I certainly can't remember a day or certainly a few days where I haven't laughed, even in the darkest of situations, is, again, I guess I'm a person who tries to seek it out. Even when terrible things have happened, I find that release really important. So I don't think it'd be somewhere I'd want to stay for very long. I have certainly been in times and spaces where you feel people suck the funny out of the room, or they suck the fun out of the room, and you're like, oh God, this is going to be really tricky. And you have to understand that, and you know that's something that you accept. But you know that feeling when someone just sucks it out the room, and you're like, "Oh, this is not good."
I call those people dementors, like in Harry Potter. You know, they're a comedy black hole.
Yeah,
you know, and all the comedy just gets dragged out of the place. On a serious note, that is, I think, what makes people more employable. And we're about to go into a time where how to get employed is going to be much more difficult. I think everybody agrees with that. And so I think what people have to understand, and from a leader like yourself, is what will make them a better part of the team, what will make them more genuinely somebody who you want to have around. And that comes down to personality, but I think you're saying that humour is a big part of that.
Humour is a big part of that. Kindness is a huge part of me. It's such an overused term in a way that, you know, it seems to be applicable to so many different aspects, but it is a universally important thing for me, that, you know, I need to see someone who's empathetic, who's kind, who, even if you're asking someone to deal with tough situations or scenarios, or that job requires a certain characteristic that perhaps would not be aligned to kindness in the first reading of the job description, that's still what I'm looking for underneath it. And I don't expect people to be stand-up comedians, but it's just, again, that shared connection of laughter, that, you know, it's just finding those moments of lightness and brevity. And I think if you're a kind person who has good intentions and is humble and honourable, you'll quite often be somebody who can quickly laugh too. I think it kind of all goes hand in hand.
Well, we were talking to Alistair McGowan about this same thing earlier on. We were talking about that there's a difference between wit and funny. And wit, and you said, you know, somebody who is warm and kind.
Mm.
And I think that is to do with humour, as in humanising.
Mm. And absolutely.
The warmth is, I think, a part of humour.
Mm.
And you don't have to be the person who is making the jokes to be part of the funny, if you see what I mean. You can be a great audience, you can be a great listener, you can give off the right vibe that invites other people to be funny. And if you are giving off that, you're vital to that thing. What do you think about that?
I think that's a great point. I mean, you know, like I talked about before, the thrill of making someone laugh. There are people who will always want to seek out the audience for their humour and their conversation. And, you know, sometimes it's just as joyous to be the people who are laughing as it is to be the people who are making someone else laugh. So I will always count the best moments of my life, I think, laughing till I cry, you know, and there are people in my life who I know I will do that with on a regular daily basis sometimes. There's not, literally, for me, I think it's probably the best feeling in the world, laughing until you cry. I can't think of anything that comes close to that feeling. Soundless, tearful laughter is the best possible feeling in the world. You can't bottle it. I don't think you can get it from anything else. And sometimes the people doing the laughing is just as important as the people making you laugh.
It's a symbiotic process, isn't it? It's a two-way street. You have to. And what I loved when you said earlier is that you laugh easily. And you love to laugh.
Yeah.
But by the way, that is a very attractive trait to anybody listening out there. That is as important. I have a great friend who is witty, but is not as quick as the rest of us when we're doing gags. But we love him because he laughs so easily and he's a joy to be around.
I think if you can find someone who you want to laugh with, that is really important. And I have a few friends that I will always love to laugh with, and I look forward to seeing them because I know I'm going to laugh, and that I look forward to that feeling and feel renewed and energized after it happens. Sometimes exhausted as well, because obviously laughter can be tiring sometimes too. But yeah.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
But isn't that wonderful? You see, I'm looking at your face and you see, this is what happens. You just have to think about those people.
Mm.
And a smile plays across your face.
Yeah,
and it changes your whole mood. And that's, you know, I think, you know, that's what business should do as well. We all spend so much time at work. But if you can bring some laughter into a workplace scenario, you're doing everybody a favour.
Yeah, because it's so good for you. You know, laughter, as we know, is, you talked about it being the best medicine, but, you know, there's, I mean, you'll know this better than anyone, but the science to show how good laughing is for you, it releases endorphins, it releases chemicals in the body that help relax you. It releases chemicals that are similar to the love chemical, you know, oxytocin, like all of those chemicals are released. So actually being quick to laugh and finding people that help you do that is going to make you feel better and feel good, whether it's conscious or I've done it consciously or unconsciously. I think I've sought out that good feeling when I've certainly, particularly in more difficult times. But it really is so good for you.
Well, we should bottle it and sell
we
it.
We should. I mean, it's surprising that no one's been able to do that yet. I mean, they kind of have, but it's not legal.
Yeah, well, cut that bit.
Cut that out.
Do you find yourself funny?
I guess I find myself funny. I've never really told myself a joke, but I'm sure
I think you just did. I think you just did. And it killed.
Anyway, sorry. Yeah, maybe I do. But sometimes it's the ridiculousness of myself sometimes that I find funny. But yeah.
Well, but that's it. But you see, funny is also, from psychologically, a belief system. Of like, you know, do I believe I can be? Because if you go, I'm not funny, I'm not funny, I'm not funny, you will walk into every situation expecting that to be the truth. But you've just actually showed in the round, you've just gone, yes, I do think I'm funny, because people react and I laugh. And, you know, part of being funny, And to those of you just listening on the podcast, Georgie has a face that lights up. No, it's. I mean, it's Blackpool Tower, ladies and gentlemen. But it is, and that's a gift. I've done gigs where I've had people in the audience who've had resting bitch face.
I have heard that term, yes.
And everything. If there is an opposite to resting bitch face, you've got it.
Wow.
Write in and tell us what that is. Do you think people laugh enough at work?
In the places I've worked, yes. But then I've worked in media and creative environments that tends to attract sort of quite large personalities or people who like the crowd and like to kind of, you know, show off, I suppose, to a certain extent. There's a lot of natural, people who like the limelight in media and the creative industry. So I think I probably have a career path that has attracted people who like to make people laugh or certainly can tell a good story and to engage a crowd. I think it doesn't happen in all workplaces potentially, but I certainly in the world I've worked, there's always been laughter. So I feel incredibly lucky to have chosen this career path, and probably in time when I go to retire or I eventually ever change direction, I think one of the lasting things I would say is I really laughed a lot. That was really funny.
I'm really interested to sort of develop that a little bit more, because you said because of the media you think that. I think humour is in all good workplaces. Mm. and places where the leaders are actually encouraging people to have fun, because there's an American statistic that 85% of all your success in life is down to the quality of your relationship, and people crave fun. I mean, as a leader, we have a lot of leaders listening to this podcast, I'm sure. But if you can create an environment, so I'm not sure it is just about media. I think it's just about good leadership. What do you think about that?
I've worked for some very serious people as well who take leadership incredibly seriously. I think probably the leaders I've gravitated towards over time have certainly been the ones who were funnier or certainly used humour effectively in the workplace. And I think in terms of team culture and motivation, I think motivation through fun, enjoyment and humour can be, I think, certainly how I've been managed, can be absolutely one of the most effective leadership tools. And I think can create lasting, you know, deep bonds between human beings. And, you know, you're going into work for perhaps a different reason than you would just to collect a paycheck. You're going in because you're having a good time. And we used to, way back in the day in one of my sort of early jobs, we used to have such a good time. We used to say to each other at the end of the week, would you have done this for free this week? And, you know, well, of course, we all have bills to pay. The answer would have been, yeah, maybe I would have done, you know. And that for me was when we were getting paid absolutely nothing anyway, so probably wouldn't have mattered. But it was that thing of, I think I might have done it for free this week. It was just so good. We had such a good time.
But I think you can build that case in any workplace. I really do. And you go, okay, media, it's more fun. We have more parties, we're doing it, but it's still a serious job.
Yeah.
Actually, if you work in a donut shop, is there any reason you can't create a fun atmosphere where people are laughing? They're serious when they're doing their job.
Yeah.
It's possible. And I think that's going to be what the next generation of leaders have to really understand and take on board, is that this is going to be, as I said before, the difference that makes a difference to any workplace. And all those people who are going, well, you know, we're having trouble with retention and everything. Guess what? People who are laughing at work, the story you told, Georgie, are less likely to leave. You know, and
because you make deep, you make close emotional bonds with people, it becomes about human relationships over the work you're doing. And I think, you know, when people are laughing at work or certainly finding humor in the workplace, and I think, you know, more so now than ever, it's important when we're not together, we're socially distant, we are doing something that is so unhuman. You know, it's not in supposed to be in our DNA to be separated from one another. And I think, you know, using humor as a connector right now, or an ability to connect people across video calls, across email, across whatever platform you're using to connect with teams, it's one of those things. It's universal laughter. We all have that emotion within us. It's not something that is potentially taught or learnt. You know, we're all able, or should all be able, to laugh. So I definitely think in a more remote first working environment, people will have to get very smart about how they use humor to connect teams when you can't actually physically be with one another. And I think successful leaders will definitely invest time in doing that.
If I asked you to make a business case for humor, what would you include?
I'd probably include every single scientific paper that's ever been written about how good laughter is for you physically and emotionally. And, you know, good leaders and good businesses should want happy, healthy, relaxed staff, because that is where not only do you get the best out of people, the best teams are formed, the best results are created for whatever industry you're in. You know, you have to invest in things that are going to bring you together, and things get a leveler in an intensely stressful situation for most people. And I think laughter is a great way to do that. And I think it can build real resilience as well. I think if you can find the humor, it can build resilience in teams and people in yourself. Because if you're trying to seek out the funny, then, you know, your chances are you're going to bounce back.
I think that's brilliant. So how would you actually measure ROI, return on investment?
Maybe it should be ROL, return on laughter, instead.
Oh, I love that. That's going Maybe. In the book.
You can have that one. Yeah, return on laughter. I mean, it's for me, it's about healthy, happy staff who are emotionally available and there for one another, and that's in the good times and the bad. And but, you know, staff well-being, staff mental health, good positive mental health, teams that are confident and want to create positive change and do good work and do good things, I think that laughter is something that connects all of those ambitions. I think laughter can really move on tough situations quite quickly, so I would think that there's a good return on investment in every area.
By the way, that's a chapter on its own in the new book. It's brilliant, because I you mentioned resilience. Of course, that is what happens. It sounds like it's, you know, the podcast, the underlying, the serious business of comedy at work, but it is kind of serious. When you have resilience, guess what? You use the term bouncing back. Well, you have to create the culture first, in my view. And you can't just go, you know, everything's gone to pot and you go, well, why can't you just laugh at it? You know, you have to have built a culture whereby there is fun, there is good energy. Then you can get resilience.
And creating a space for laughter, I think, you know, you have to let that space be allowed to happen. You know, you have to let those moments happen. You have to allow the laughter to come. You have to allow the tears to come. You have to let the emotions come at work. And laughter is, you know, often, you know, crying is sort of just laughter upside down and vice versa. And you have to allow space for all of it. And, you know, you can't just allow space for the laughter, because that solely laughter, you have to let space for all emotions to appear. And I think that's when great teams are built, is you allow the space for the emotion to come. And whilst we always want it to be laughter, sometimes it's not. Sometimes it's the exact opposite of that. But I think if people know that both all and any emotion is and can find a space in the workplace, whether that's publicly or privately, I think that that's when people realize that they're humans at work. They're not numbers. They're not results. They are human beings who are valued by other human beings. And we are human beings with complex sets of emotions. And, you know, I would always love to think that laughter is one of the first emotions that people can find at ACAST, but, you know, sometimes it's just not. And that's okay too. And you've got to allow space for all of it.
Well, as a psychologist, I can tell you that if you allow, and by the way, that should be your new book, allow space for the emotions, you know, space for the emotions. I can see it now. It's a great title. A little thing. But you're quite right that I'm coming at it just from the humor angle, but you've hit on something perfect, because if you allow space for laughter, you have to allow space for some tears. But remember that one can lean over into the other very, very quickly. So that's fabulous. I mean, I think you've got your TED talk all sorted now.
I just go on stage and start crying and laughing at the same time, and everyone will be like, who is this quite odd woman who's just standing up here laughing and crying? But, like, you know, those two emotions are very closely linked to me. And, like, we cry with laughter, and sometimes, you know, the reverse happens too. But I'm a big believer in giving the space to let it happen in a way that I think people then feel that my emotions are respected here, my emotions are understood. I therefore bring my whole self to work. I don't have to hide elements of who I am, because everything is kind of accepted. And I think you find that laughter usually tends to be the number one emotion that most people lead with when they know they've got the space to do everything else.
Oh, I think that's brilliant. But I'm just going to your new career. And look, ladies and gentlemen, next on Oprah, the laughing, crying woman.
Oh, I promise you I'll dedicate the book to you, Paul. Promise.
It's going to be huge. I can tell you that. No, it's, have you ever taken a joke too far? Have you ever pushed the boundaries?
I hope not. But the line is always really personal to the individual, isn't it? You know, my line is different from yours, is different from anyone else's. So I really hope not. I like to think I'm a good reader of people's emotions to understand if I'm even close to a line, or if someone is close to a line. And I would always try and, you know, stop the gag, stop the joke, or, you know, if I would like to feel that I could understand if someone was uncomfortable. But the line is really personal. I hope not.
And in order to be funny, which is why I asked the question, sometimes you do have to push the boundaries. What do you think?
Yeah, I think that is true if you are making a career and a profession potentially out of being funny. I think sometimes when it's the joke at someone else's expense is not always the route that I find the funniest. I think that's sometimes the lowest common denominator on humour. And it's one that I would always kind of seek to avoid. I would always self-deprecate before I did anything ever to kind of do anything similar to anyone else. But I think you can push the lines and the boundaries if that is what you are known for and that is your choice of career. I think in leadership roles particularly, I think it's a place that you have to be, whilst, you know, let the laughter come, I think you have to not necessarily be the one to ever push the boundaries. And if you ever think you're ever close to a line, you have to take a very, very big step backwards.
No, I completely agree. But you talked about self-deprecation. Do you think that good leaders can employ that?
I think, you know, if you're quick to laugh at yourself, if you're, you know, there is a narrative to say that women are very self-deprecating because we often want to point out our flaws before other people do. And, you know, you're doing it because there's a level of imposter syndrome that quite often that women experience. And quite often, you know, female comedians or women in the public eye who want to be funny is usually at the expense of themselves, and it's a very self-deprecating type of humor. I certainly employ self-deprecation. I will always try, if someone's going through a tough time, I'll always try and give an experience of when I did it and what a mess I made of something and how funny it all turned out to be. And, you know, I'll always try and point out a flaw or spot a flaw and give someone the joke before they can potentially get to the punchline themselves. But it's a really interesting, I think, more gender nuanced type of humour that women tend to be more self-deprecating than men, or certainly I see that in a lot of stand-up comedians through observational humour. It's interesting. It's a tool, although there is more and more research to say that perhaps it has held women back over time, because you're quite often pointing out your flaws ahead of someone else, perhaps even noticing it was one, but you're making the joke of it before someone else gets there. Usually always been my humour format of choice to be self-deprecating. I'm sometimes just assessing a little bit, why am I doing that? Is it because it's helping them and making them feel better? Or am I just trying to point out a flaw that didn't need to be done in a way that I've just done?
It's interesting that you use the word imposter syndrome, because I think most people have imposter syndrome. And what I think, and this is a huge generalization, what men are better at is pushing through that and having the arrogance to just go with it. I think everybody has it, but actually maybe women are slightly more sensitive to it and therefore are nicer people and therefore are doing that. And it also therefore means that other people can take advantage of that.
I've certainly had experiences before where I make myself the crux of the joke, or I'm self-deprecating, but then to hear someone repeat it back to me where I'm the butt, because I've allowed it, it's a very different experience actually. And it's something that you know, be mindful of if you're using self-deprecation as a tool and as a way, a leveler, and as a way to kind of create laughter. It's sometimes quite different when someone says that, uses it back to you, and they kind of say, but you said you made it funny, you made it a joke. And it's like, well, it's a delicate line when I make it a joke about myself versus someone else using it as a joke at my expense. It's that level of, I'm allowed to make myself the butt of the joke, but are you allowed to make me the butt of the joke?
It's about boundaries at that point, isn't it? It's about, and I think what, and this is, you know, just a huge generalization again, men are better at pushing through that and just having the arrogance to just go, yes, I am the real deal.
Yeah, I think there's a bravado, isn't there, that sometimes
is a more perfect word,
is a more masculine trait. I've certainly met lots of women with bravado too, but I think it tends to be a more masculine trait, and I think self-deprecation tends to be a more feminine trait. And whether it's gender specific or just traits that people to bring as part of themselves, you know, it's interesting when I sometimes hear someone else be self-deprecating, I'm like, hey, that's not funny, you're really good at that, like, you know, that's not something that you should be pointing out or making a joke about. And then I think, God, I do that all the time. You know, it's an interesting thing when you see it flipped as well. When you see someone else overuse it, you think, oh God, yeah, maybe that is something that we need to think about as a leader. Am I using it too much? Am I making it too much of a thing that actually is unnecessary and is inspiring other people to do the same, and it's not necessary?
Well, I work with a lot of high profile, powerful women, so I know that. And particularly when we're doing things like working on a big set piece speech for a big event, I have to take a lot of those things out, because I go, they really don't want to hear that bit. If you know what I mean, it's like, we don't need that. We didn't need that thought process to be put in our minds. Yes, it's funny, but there are other ways of being humorous at this point. And so I do think it, and I think this is very useful for people to hear, because a female leader talking about this kind of stuff, I think is very a useful tool for people to go, oh, I feel like that. But the fact that you're questioning it and we're talking about it, I think it's very empowering. And I just think you go, you don't need to, because men will do it less, because they thing. So, and as a psychologist, what I'm always trying to look at is who does things really well. You know, if I were looking for somebody who does empathy and easy laughter and warmth really well, I'd come and I mean this sincerely, I'd come and model what you were doing, Georgie. No, but I am serious, because I'm always looking for a thing. But sometimes men are just better at just going, no, I'm great, everybody stand in line. And I kind of call it the old Eton thing. You know, how come we've had six prime ministers who went to Eton? I went to a comprehensive with 2,000 boys. Not one prime minister.
Not yet. Not yet.
But
Not yet.
I'm waiting for a call, you know.
Yeah, I would vote for you, Paul. But I think I hope change is coming in that regard. And I hope that men understand and know that you don't have to be a specific type of man to succeed. And I think the more empathy and kindness and understanding that we can put into both genders' attitudes towards leadership and motivating teams, I do think that, as much as I'm sitting here as a woman saying, oh, it's about imposter syndrome as a woman and as we self-deprecate, I think men have been shown for a very long time there's a very specific way to lead and there's a very specific way to gain success. And I hope that is starting to become less frequent. And I think there's a lot of work to do with the young men coming through organisations to just show that you don't have to be like you think you do to be successful here. And I genuinely think the change is coming. And I hope when I eventually leave this industry, I'll be leaving it in a much more inclusive, diverse, empathetic, kind, funny, fun place where those are the qualities that matter, not necessarily the bravado, the ego and everything else that goes with it.
I couldn't agree more. And the sooner that people wake up to it, and these conversations are what I hope and what this is about, that people wake up to these kind of things and go, you know what, these are great qualities. Humour, empathy, rapport. These are the things that really do define people, not bravado and bluster. Have you ever used humour to get you out of trouble?
Yes, I think it can be a brilliant distraction technique and kind of almost like a verbal sleight of hand. So I guess not out of trouble, so to speak. I think I would always own up to it. If I'd done something wrong or made a mistake, I'm definitely someone who owns up to it and hands up, I've done something wrong. And, you know, but I've certainly used it as a distraction. I'm like, look over here instead, you know, don't look at that. But, out of trouble, I think I would always own up to the trouble. I definitely have in the past.
In business, is it survival of the fittest or survival of the funniest?
I don't think it's either really fittest or, you know, survival of the fittest or survival of the funniest. I actually think that laughter is essential for human survival, full stop. And, you know, to have a well-lived life, and, you know, people who live well and have well-lived lives tend to, I think, survive the longest, you know, as we know. But I'm not sure if it's either, but I certainly think laughter is part of social survival for sure.
Well, we're now coming to the part of the show that we call quick fire questions.
Right.
And I had Spike Edney on from Queen, who's the fifth member and musical director of Queen. And I said, every time I say quick fire questions, I imagine that I've got a jingle. And so so he wrote one off the top of his head.
Right. Amazing.
So you're going to have to go quick fire questions.
You can do that for me. There you go. You've done it.
OK, well, we'll get you to do it later. So quick fire questions. Who's the funniest business person you've met?
John O'Donnell at the Evening Standard. He was my boss for a long time. One of the naturally gifted comedians. Actually, I think also did some stand up for some time as well. But a natural gift for comedy. Absolutely.
What book makes you laugh?
Anything written by Catlin Moran.
Superb. Yes.
Yeah, incredible.
What a comedy mind. I completely agree.
Just her observational humour and the way that she can draw laughter out of, you know, what are very normal life situations. And what I love about her is she can draw attention to really important political and social and cultural conversations using humour in her writing. And I always so admire that trait to be able to elevate important topics via humour in writing. And I think she does it beautifully.
What film makes you laugh, Georgie?
I think definitely films from my childhood and my teenage years, and it probably more is aligned to specific memories and times of my life. But anything from like Ghostbusters to The Goonies to Back to the Future, I kind of have some very, very fond memories of laughing till I cried with my sister at those films and repeating the lines back to each other endlessly in the car on car journeys, probably much to the annoyance of my mum. But yeah, we used to just verbatim repeat those films back to each other, and we still do now from time to time. And, you know, whenever I watch those films, I always laugh and feel great while I do it.
Who are you going to call?
My sister.
And do you know what? It works perfectly. Who are you going to call? My sister. What word makes you laugh?
Don't laugh.
Do you know why that works?
Why?
Psychologically.
Go on.
Because that, in linguistic terms, is a negation. Mm-hmm. And you can't tell somebody what not to do.
Right.
So if you say don't laugh.
That's it. Game over for me. If someone says don't laugh, but that's it. I've started laughing internally at least. And I'm like, look, okay, well, you're going to have to tell me this without looking at me now. Because if I make eye contact with you after you told me not to laugh, I'm going to start laughing. So we have to now either do this over a call. I'm going to have to turn my back on you while you tell me this story.
Brilliant. Actually, that's my favourite answer of the series. Don't laugh. I mean, superb. On a serious note, what's not funny?
Misogyny, racism, homophobia, particularly when used by people who are using it to cause hurt, and the joke is intended to hurt particularly. I think there is some brilliant writers and comedians from those particular communities who can use their own experience to tell a story and to put you in their shoes using comedy. And probably at the heart of that story is an experience of racism, homophobia or misogyny, but any group or community who's using that joke to cause harm or specific offence, those are the things that I absolutely do not find funny.
Hear, hear. Would you rather be considered clever or funny?
I don't want to choose. I would like to be both. I'd like to think that someone said I used humour in a clever way. I think you can be both.
And actually, my argument would follow that, actually, because I don't think you can be funny without being clever.
True. Very true.
If you think about it, you know, yeah. I saw your brain go, is there anybody who's funny that wasn't clever? Even comedians you didn't like who were funny to other people, they are clever. They've got linguistic talents or, you know, physical talents that they can make you laugh. And the act of being funny, I think, demands a real intelligence to do it. And I know so many comedians, and they are, to a man, intelligent. Desert island gags. You've got one gag that you can take with you to a desert island. What is it?
I am a huge fan of jokes that can be said in a sentence. The one I would take with me would be, my therapist says I have a preoccupation with vengeance. We'll see about that.
I absolutely love it. It's yours and it's going with you to the desert island.
Thank you.
Georgina Holt, thank you so much for your humour and your humanity.
Thank you so much for having me, Paul. It's been a joy, and thank you for making me laugh. I won't forget it.
The Humorology podcast was hosted by Paul Barros and produced by Simon Banks. Music by Steve Hayworth, creative direction by Les Hughes, and additional research by Helen Sykes. Please remember to subscribe, like, and leave a review wherever you get your podcasts. This has been a Big Sky production.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.